questions brief and to speak so that everyone can hear. Interfaith Action, Southwest Michigan Peace and Justice Collaborative is, oh wait, I forgot to tell you who I am. I was so busy. I'm Faith Schoon, and I'm the president of the League of Women Voters, Berrien at Cass County. We are doing this in conjunction with the Interfaith Action Council or Collaborative. They're a coalition of various faith communities who understand that we're stronger when we act together. In a public policy climate where the most vocal voices are narrow and sectarian, Interfaith Action seeks to bring justice-oriented and interfaith voices back into the conversation. The overarching purpose of Interfaith Action, woven from differing faith traditions, is the expression of love and action for the healing of our world. Interfaith Action's work is done through working groups and community partners. We aim to promote the dignity of all human beings, peacemaking and countering violence, the advancement of justice, especially for those on the margins of community life, and the upholding of the holiness of all creation. The League of Women Voters is a nonpartisan political organization. We work to increase understanding of major public policy issues without expressing a political position. The League works to educate voters and to advocate for the common good in our communities. Many people today think that the U.S. government should declare America a Christian nation and base its laws on Christian values, commonly known as Christian nationalism. This viewpoint has major implications for the future relation of church and state in America. To learn more about this movement and more generally about the public role of religion in American life, the League of Women Voters, Berrien Cass County, and Interfaith Action of Southwest Michigan are sponsoring this evening's discussion. The forum will open with observation by two students of the issue, Dr. Clark Gilpin, former dean and historian of Christianity at the University of Chicago Divinity School, and Reverend Jeffrey Hubers, senior pastor of the First Congregational Church in St. Joseph's. The forum will then open to questions and comments from the participants. Please welcome Dr. Gilpin and Reverend.
Thank you, everyone. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
All right, good. This is a good room for that close quarters. So thank you for coming tonight. I want to begin my portion of this evening between Dr. Gilpin and myself. I want to focus on power and identity. That is what I'm talking about in regards to Christian nationalism. Now, Faith gave us a very brief definition, but that is part of the issue when we talk about something like Christian nationalism, like even Christianity in general. Dr. Gilpin will talk about how there is a plurality of meaning often when we come to these terms and we have these discussions around what are these varying ideologies, whether it's Christianity, whether it's nationalism. So we're not talking about patriotism. We're not talking about love of country, love of God, even though those are often the languages used to sort of mask Christian nationalism. Rather, Dr. Gilpin will show there is a variety of meaning, but what I want to do is provide sort of a fuller definition for our own context, and then go forward to talk about this power and identity that is really pivotal in trying to grasp this, what I want to call an ideology that invites meaning for people, like many ideologies do. So for our own context, it's important to know Christian nationalism is not a solely American identity. And it's not even a recent phenomenon, even though for many of us, Christian nationalism seems to be a term that has become popular in the recent decade. Christian nationalism is something that is actually quite ancient, and we might say that it goes back to a sense of religious nationalism and even a sense of colonialism and imperialism dating back to when Christianity took over this sense of empire. And it, you couldn't tell the difference any longer between a Christian kingdom and a Christian community. So that goes back, right, centuries. But we might find this more focused identity of a Christian nation during the period of the nation states into the early modernity. But we especially get the form that we want to talk about tonight for our context, what's going on in America, coming out of this Eurocentrism. We can even date it back to the time of the colonies. But I would say a more recent example in modernity is what we see in the rise of Arianism, what we see in the Nazi Party in Germany. Those were Christians, or they identified as such. Church and state were one. The Reich was supposed to be a 1,000-year reign of Christ. That's really important because that informs what is continuing to happen today. So let me give this identity. I want to talk about what is it in our own context. So this is one definition. This comes from Anthea Butler. And after the January 6th insurrection, there was a Baptist Joint Committee that wrote a series of papers on the events of that day. But this is what they said, and I quote, "Christian nationalism is a political ideology and a cultural framework that seeks to merge American and Christian identities. Christian nationalism demands a privileged place for Christianity in public life, buttressed by the active support of government at all levels. Christian nationalism is not Christianity, though it is not accurate to say that Christian nationalism has nothing to do with Christianity. Christian nationalism relies on Christian imagery and language," end quote. Christian nationalism, what I want to focus on tonight, is an ideology about power. It is a framework for trying to decide whose power and who gets to have that power. Who gets to wield it? That's the questions. Those are the questions that this ideology wants to answer. So a big piece of this is interpretation. How do we interpret history? How do we interpret scripture? Christian nationalism uses what many religions actually hold dear, which is a sense of exceptionalism. Many faiths practice this, and in a lot of ways, it's part of the terrain. We go to our sacred texts to find that there is this identity we are given by the divine, that we are loved, that we are we have meaning, we have belonging. And there's nothing wrong with that at face value. That is important. Religions provide identity and meaning. But the issue here is that Christian nationalism marries that with power. And the degree by which it makes the superiority of its group, namely Christians, Christians of a certain color, Christians of a certain gender, Christians of a certain political leaning, they must be superior through an actual endangerment of the public square. There is a sense of threat in how the public square is engaged. So if Christianity, especially in the US, is about power and control, what happens when they face loss? What happens when suddenly that power that was wielded at cultural levels, at societal levels, suddenly seems gone, suddenly seems stripped? That's fear of loss is what drives the system. A fear of loss drives nationalism. We get so much rhetoric of it was better back then. It was better in those days. But the follow-up question is always better for who and why? You see, fear of loss promotes an ethic of triumphalism, which again is inherent in many religions. But it comes from a sense of interpreting the scriptures, interpreting history, that God is willing the success of a certain group or groups. And so Christian nationalism takes that story, takes that identity, that there is a superior group, a group that's supposed to be in power, that is supposed to be over and against others, And it's also fueled by a fear-based reaction to loss, a loss of cultural and political significance. Oftentimes what we find, here are the intersectional components: a loss surrounding issues of gender, around sex, around conservative political values. So the white conservative Christian is the model, that's the means. And if that group no longer has superiority, no longer has majority, then the threat must become, we have to take it back. We have to reclaim it. We have to build a bigger wall. We have to put up a higher fence. But here's the harm in that, as a pastor, as a Christian. From my viewpoint, Christian nationalism is idolatry. Because what is happening is there is an image, whether that is of the nation, whether that is of the religion, and that is the God. Not the what we are pointing to in our faith, but rather it is the ideal, the nation, the persona. Mark Charles and Soon Chan Ra, they wrote a book called The Doctrine or The Doctrine of Discovery. And it goes back to something that happened at the onset of sort of not the discovery, because in order to discover something, that means it can't be inhabited, right? Something that's happened, that's called stealing. But they said this, in the way that American documents were started to be framed and utilized, they said this, and I quote, "If the full expression of God's image is found in the rational common sense mind of the European, then the white European American is elevated above other bodies and minds. Belief in exceptionalism is fundamentally related to how people view themselves in relationship to God. The sin of setting up one's own image as the ultimate ideal results in an exaggerated self-perception. And that assumption of superiority allows the white American Christian to take a position of final authority over who has greater access to the benefits of American society." Now, that's the theological arc. Again, this isn't, oh, but hey, look at the white guy talking. Right? White Christian guy that grew up in those same conservative values. We don't say, woe is me, because here's the truth. I think from a political standpoint, what is a democracy? A democracy thrives by its ability to protect all its citizens. Especially a democracy has diverse expressions of race and religion and culture. America, whatever we think about its founding. And again, Dr. Gilpin will highlight that there's a plurality of meaning. We can look at history, the actual history, and find that even though there were Christians in the founders, there were deists, there were people who wanted nothing to do with where they came from in Europe because of the violence, the nationalism that they encountered there, even so, whatever we think was happening then, there was still this framing of a constitution, of a protection, that there was a shared space, a shared identity known as the public sphere. Christian nationalism poses a threat to that because it is offering an unequal proportion of society. Because for white Christian communities, the idea is that they would maintain a greater resource of protection, of privilege. And it's oftentimes, as it was in segregation, as it was in Jim Crow, as it has been for many years, it comes at the expense of those that were segregated from. So let me just say this. The impact, what we're concerned about, this notion of power and identity, even though Christian nationalism has repercussions for Christianity, it plagues all religious expression, even those that are non-theistic, because it represents a violent hegemony. It's a threat for other expressions. Other expressions that, guess what? They're American too. But it threatens their ability to participate freely and fairly in the system that people of those faiths, people of those beliefs or non-beliefs have fought and died for, just as all of our forebears. Christian nationalism also props up, again, there is a singular group That's the negative side, the harm of exceptionalism. There is a single group that is chosen, a single group that is on the side of the divine. And then that idea that exceptionalism becomes weaponized. And religious liberty, which has always been a shield that guards people in their practice of faith, in their ability to worship, it no longer is a shield, but it is a sword. And that's why it's so dangerous. That's not how it's written. That's not how it was even intended. If you read some of those documents. So let me close before I turn over to Dr. Gilpin. Again, as a pastor, I have to go to text. I have to go to tradition. And what I find, despite a history in which Christianity has so often worshiped power, so often used that power to try and do good, but oftentimes it's a double-edged sword and cuts self as often as it cuts others. Jesus said this in Mark 10, 35, 45. James and John, disciples, sons of Zebedee, they come forward and they say to Jesus, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you." Jesus says, "What is it you want me to do?" And they say, "Appoint for us one to sit on your left and one for your right." Jesus says, "You don't know what you are asking. Can you drink the cup I drink? Can you be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with?" And they say, "Yes." Like we all would. "Yes, we can." But Jesus says, "The cup I drink, you will drink. The baptism I'm baptized, you will be baptized with. But to sit at my right hand and my left, that is not for you to know." The 10 heard this, right? The other disciples, and they're angry with James and John. And so Jesus calls to them and he says, "You know, the Gentiles, you know, they lord it over them. They lord over those they recognize as leaders, and their great ones are tyrants over them. But it is not so among you. Whoever wishes to be great must become your servant. And whoever wishes to be first among you must be slave of all. For the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many." That lens, a lens of self-giving, a lens of service, that becomes what the church proclaims in one of its earliest hymns, Philippians 2, known as the Christ hymn to some. It was a song perhaps sung by the early church, and it says this: "Let each of you look not to your own interests, but to the interests of others. Let the same mind be in you that was in Christ Jesus, who, though he existed in the form of God, did not regard equality with God as something to be grasped, something to be exploited." That word actually is very violent in the Greek. I won't say it here. But Jesus did not do that. He emptied himself, taking the form of a slave, assuming human likeness, and being found in appearance as a human, he humbled himself and became obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. So this is why I close with cross and resurrection. Those are the symbols of Christianity. And it's ironic how cross, which was a form of suffering by the empire, suddenly becomes a symbol of the success of empire, the power of empire. But we forget that Jesus died a criminal, died an enemy of the state. But that's not the whole story. The second half of that is resurrection. And in that resurrection, Jesus shows that humility is the way forward. Self-giving, life not for self but for the world. So that is the narrative that Christianity wrestles with. And each generation must continue to practice that. Each community of faith has to practice the values that their tradition holds dear. Traditions that for many of the world's religions, humility, self-giving, and life for the world, those are the values that continue to instill what I think is true community values that are important in a democracy. But Dr. Gilpin, your turn.
Clark Gilpin. Title for what I want to comment on is "A Diverse Nation Confronts Christian Nationalism." 55 years ago, Richard Nixon's presidential advisor, Patrick Buchanan, wrote the following. We are in a contest over the soul of our country now. And the decision, Buchanan continues, the decision will not be some middle compromise. It will be their kind of society or ours. Both academic sociologists and presidents of the United States have worried for decades about the soul of America. In addition to its religious connotations, this phrase raises a more general issue about the principles and values that provide continuity and collective identity to American democracy. National polls indicate that significant numbers of people agree that the nation is going in the wrong direction. What I read this morning was like 73%. The nation is going in the wrong direction, but these same citizens disagree about what the direction should be. When a diverse, pluralistic nation confronts Christian nationalism, how do we respond? During most of the year 2023, the Public Religion Research Institute and its president, Robert P. Jones, conducted national surveys of this polarized social environment that identified one politically vocal group with the name White Christian Nationalism. The Public Religion Institute asked a broad interracial spectrum of Americans to respond to five statements. You don't need to memorize these, but just picture these five statements as I read each of them. The U.S. government should declare, the U.S. government should declare America a Christian nation. U.S. laws should be based on Christian values. If the U.S. moves away from our Christian foundation, we will not have a country anymore. Being Christian is an important part of being truly American, the exceptionalism we're talking about. God has called Christians to exercise dominion over all areas of American society. Based on approximately 22,000 survey responses to these five statements, the Public Religion Research Institute identified four categories of respondents. Again, just picture these four responding categories. Category one, Christian nationalism adherence, 10% of the nation. Christian nationalism sympathizers, 20% of Americans. Christian nationalism skeptics, 37% of Americans. And Christian nationalism rejectors, 30% of Americans. North Dakota and Mississippi had the highest percentage of Christian nationalist adherents and sympathizers at 50%. Michigan ranked somewhat below the national average with 26% of its residents, Michigan residents, identifying as adherents or sympathizers. Note especially the diversity of these responses. Phrases such as Christian values and Christian foundations are left undefined in the Public Religion Institute survey. American Christians, as we've heard, sharply disagree over the substance content of these phrases. Consequently, survey responders are present in all four groups of self-identified Christians. You find Christian nationalism adherents, Christian nationalism sympathizers, Christian nationalism skeptics, and Christian nationalism rejectors. Diversity. Interfaith Action of Southwest Michigan contributes to this discussion by organizing its work in accord with three faith-based and democracy-supporting principles: our common life, our common home, and our common good. Democratic justice for all, in the classic phrase. As we prepare for a critical election this year and for hard work healing the divides of our country, further dialogue and advancement on these themes and our interfaith public theology are essential to pursue the enhancement of our common good. I want to make three brief comments on the necessity of interactive interfaith dialogue. Rather than overemphasizing individualism, I think we live meaningful lives by recognizing that our individuality, our personal self, arise from our intrinsic commitment to mutual responsibility. In a series of lectures delivered in 1961 by Martin Luther King Jr., King declared that as individuals, as a nation, and as a universal community, we find our freedom not as individuals, but as an inclusive community of mutual responsibility. We authentically embody and pursue the American dream within a larger dream. To introduce King's comment during his 1959 visit to India, King stated this larger dream as an unbounded geography. Through our scientific genius, he writes, we have made of this world a neighborhood. Now, through our moral and spiritual development, we must make it a brotherhood. King stated, we must come to see that no individual can live alone. We must all live together. We must all be concerned about each other. All life is interrelated. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. When Christian nationalists advocate an official declaration that the United States is a Christian nation, what Martin Luther King had called the inescapable network of mutuality has become far too narrow. The social reality is that the United States is a religiously diverse nation, and increasingly so. Those who identify themselves as adherents of Christian nationalism are defining what is truly America to the exclusion of others. In a way that renders their neighbors and their co-workers invisible or unwelcome in our common life. Yet, Interfaith Action is one of many organizations that must cultivate an interfaith dialogue among and within the diverse religions of the United States. In an era of polarization, it is time for us to commit ourselves to interactive, substantive dialogue that pursues decisions that frame a goal to address our changing times. Perceptive leaders have long recognized that I did not arrive at the best idea. The best ideas are beyond us. They're achieved through careful listening, imaginative vision that create ideas through dialogue. We arrive at that idea that is beyond ourselves and that depends upon the mutuality of our collective responsibility. What ideas, practices, and values can our religions, individually and together, contribute to American democracy that enhance the welfare, dignity, and sense of mutual responsibility for each person and every community? I conclude with an observation from both James Baldwin and Martin Luther King, who both assert that change comes from the margin. We need to remember that persons on the margins of society, our legal Haitian immigrants in Springfield, Ohio, have experienced distinctive, potentially invaluable perspectives on the greater welfare of society. In an uncharacteristically outlandish statement, Martin Luther King, he doesn't usually talk this way, has this to say about one word, maladjusted. I say to you, I can't talk like King, but you can. I say to you, there are certain things within our social order to which I am proud to be maladjusted. Change comes from the margins, and to which I call upon all persons of goodwill to be maladjusted. It may well be that the salvation of our world lies in the hands of the maladjusted.
Thank you very much for your presentations and for your explanations. And now I think the audience chance to ask students. So if anyone has a question, and I am going to ask you to, if you could briefly summarize it again so that everyone will know what the question is.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, in the air.
And also for the benefit of the recording.
Yes, of course.
We have limited sound capability.
Right.
Thank you.
All right, Bill, do you want to kick us off with a short question?
Yeah, so you distinguished between Christianity as it's practiced, or at least, you know, scripture, and Christian nationalism. So I just got some questions. How embedded, from your research, have you seen Christian nationalism being in churches? And along with that goes, are there a lot of secular Christian nationalists? Mm-hmm. And are there pious Christians like yourselves pushing back on Christian nationalism from within the church or from without the church?
Let me start with the first piece. First question, how embedded is Christianity in Christian nationalism? What were you trying to reorient? Or in churches, Christian nationalism in churches. Is that the first part?
Preaching. Yeah, I mean, do pastors preach?
Here's the thing.
Power part of it?
Just like Clark mentioned before, there's a spectrum. Just like there's a spectrum in religious practice, there's a spectrum in, Christian nationalism. Adhering, sympathizing, skeptics, outright rejections. So there are not only you can just take whole traditions, but individual congregations that are vehemently against it. And some of the material I read from are from those congregations, communities, groups. The Academy has written a lot. This is part of what my doctoral work is trying to discover. There's a lot written by the Academy on Christian nationalism. There's a lot of scholarship around it because, again, it's not something recent or modern. It's ancient. In churches, it takes many forms. And I think we started to see it particularly during the last election cycle. We saw especially during COVID, because we saw again, what are we doing? How? What's the concern? Is it a concern for the public common good? Well, we need to worship together. You can't tell us not to worship. But at the same time, what's the common good? But not gathering may protect people. Not gathering may protect the least. So I think there's a variety of practice. It's a spectrum. What would you say, Clark?
I'd like to add a historical note. Let's go back to the year 1800, when Americans were inventing what we now call denominations. Mm-hmm. And the way you discriminated among Presbyterians and Methodists and Baptists, et cetera, was the easiest way was to grab hold of an idea, a doctrine, and say, this is what sets me apart from this group. That has a way over 250 years of squeezing the flexibility, the imagination, the creativity of religious theological ideas by associating who I am with the doctrine I believe. And it seems to me that one of the keys to creative dialogue, to the dialogue that can bring people together, is to remember, as I used to sing as a kid, I don't sing anymore, don't worry. I love to tell me the stories of Jesus. And I think when we start with narratives, with stories of the religions, stories of pilgrimage, stories of journeys, stories of return home, wherever that may be, these possibilities begin to enlarge. One quick thing.
Mm-hmm.
One of my greatest privileges in my academic career was the opportunity to spend 9 years every March for a week in Jerusalem. And what I discovered there with Muslim, Jewish, and Christian scholars was that the opportunity to talk to people who love books, mm-hmm, and love to debate about books and can come up with 63 or more ideas about what that book means, and to see how that generates what I said a moment ago, the way in which the better ideas emerge out of that way of storytelling. So if I had to say something concrete about dialogue, I think it would be that we need, in this era of declining significance of denominationalism in general, that we have an opportunity to sit down, as Jeffrey did, with stories, with texts, and say, how can you imagine this unfolding as a way of people who thought they couldn't agree about doctrine suddenly have ideas about what could happen with a story?
If you want data on, you know, the adherents, the sympathizers, you know, what denominations are really into this, what congregations, what systems are really into this, I think Pew Research has started that. There is data out there.
Yeah.
So do your own research. Following up to Clark's point on dialogue, it would be easy to generalize here, right? In some ways, generalization helps us as preachers. That's how we're easier to get through the world. That is maybe our biologic weakness that, in a way, Christian nationalism relies on, because they can say there is black and there is white and there is nothing between. There is our way and there is everything else which is wrong. The strength of what we're doing in conversation, in dialogue, is saying we don't have to have these strict walls between us of definition. Intersectionality, which I hear from my good friend, Mary Jo Chanel, that is gospel in some ways, because it reminds us persons are more than one thing. And that is, in a way, is our greatest strength, especially when we consider what is an American identity. American identity is more than one thing. just as a faith identity. So, but there is data, Pew Research, religion and public life. And maybe we can put together a resource list after.
That would be wonderful.
And the presentation
posted on the websites. Yes. Sir, you had a question.
Yes. In the past, I've always saw the debate between white nationalism, Christian nationalism, as the opposite of inclusive and exclusive.
Mm-hmm.
But I love your concluding remarks about the margin. They're the ones that have the power of change, and it's not inside the centralist ideas.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a brand new thought to me. I appreciate that.
Hey, if I went off the internet or off Zoom, can we take that?
Yes.
Okay.
From in the chat.
From in the chat. Yeah, this is from Larry Feldman, who I think many of you know. Larry said, what specific steps can be taken to undermine Christian nationalism and promote interfaith collaboration? You touched on that some, but I think if you might just elaborate a little bit further.
Obviously, again, this, keep talking to each other, keep listening, having community, which is true community, which means, again, there is a seat at the table for everyone. Of course, people like Malcolm X and James Baldwin talk about if that person at the table doesn't say I'm a human being, it's hard to have them at the table.
Yeah.
But still, I think, again, the first steps are always dialogue. Dialogue defeats elitism. Dialogue defeats absolutism. Our greatest resource is not trying to speak in absolutes, leaning into an embrace of the gray, you might say.
The gentleman in the plaid shirt, proceeding with that question and the storytelling, I find it very interesting that the Haitians have brought community revitalization, massive community revitalization, better activity of all kinds. I guess I'm trying to figure out how parties like us can help tell that story.
Mm-hmm.
Work with people in Ohio to come together and Wittenberg or wherever Lincoln it might be, and to say, by golly, these persons came, their crime rates are a lot less than a lot of other places. They are great on the job, knows the grindstone, just like all of our ancestors that had their bank, knows the grindstone. You know, when they came here, they worked to whatever. I'm just saying, what is a framework for the Interfaith Consortium to join with other people in helping to sponsor the storytelling of revitalization of Springfield? You know, put the words first. They've revitalized the blinking town. It all took was 20,000 people, my goodness.
Yeah.
Any other town that really is dying, and that was a dying town, that might have similar ways, and how do we tell the story? I guess is because that starts with telling the story of life and how our home, we're blessed that we don't have the dying stuff, but it could be at some point.
It took 60 years to put those denominations into working order. It was after the Civil War that they became what they are, and they continue to evolve. So the first thing I would say concretely is that this set of communities we're in, Benton Harbor, St. Joseph, Niles, Buchanan, the scale here permits an opportunity for experimentation that we might even say is unique, but we've got to stick to it. It takes time to cultivate trust. It takes time to develop the sense that the person who's a little reluctant to dive in with a view that sounds out on the edge, on the margin, to do so, and then to ask, and what are the active consequences of doing it? So, religious leaders,
lay people, congregations of all stripes, different locations. We need to come together and we need to commit to the time that tells the story.
Yes, that's your answer. Thank you. I have a question a lot about religious nationalism, because there are a lot of Muslim nationalist countries, but there's Jewish nationalists. Do you see that increasing worldwide? Like, is this a trend that outside that is America's just doing what other countries are doing? And are they motivated by the same things in those other countries?
Religious
can
nationalism.
Can you just repeat that again? Thank you.
Religious nationalism, is it something, again, unique to America? It seems to be growing. Other faiths have similar issues. Other countries do have nationalist tendencies based around religious practice. This is not recent. This is something, again, that's part of history. There's always been a marriage between sort of a religious aristocracy and control. Because again, within religious traditions, there are ideas about exceptionalism. There's an idea about who is in, who is out. And once that's partnered with power, and specifically, I think, it starts to form authoritarian rule. It starts to form regimes. And who doesn't want to say that their rule is ordained by God? That what they're doing is approved. By the gods, that's history. From Europe throughout the world, dictators have always said that this is not only legal, but it's holy. And so that's not unique to America. Is it on the rise? I think there is data that authoritarian rule has seen an increase of this violence. But at the same time, since I would say the period of decolonization that was really instrumental, those same voices, we have to return, I think, to indigenous expression, to allow people of the land, people, again, voices of the margins, that language has to become, in a sense, part of the main dialogue. Enrique Dussel, who is a liberationist theologian and philosopher, he talks about the center and periphery. So the center being the idea of the majority rule, whiteness, European, whatever it is, but then there's also the periphery, because if there's a center, someone has been pushed to the sides. What has to happen is a decentering. We have to decenter these ideas of a singular party, a singular regime, a singular religion running things. And that's part of the transformation from the periphery. Do you have anything to add?
Oh, I do, but I heard something.
Christian nationalism, as you say, is not a denomination. It is an ideology. But what I'd like to know is, how is it organized?
Mm.
If it's not a denomination, how is it organized? And who are the names? Who are the leaders? It can't just be a diverse, someone over here saying this, someone in this state saying this. It's got to be organized, isn't it? How is it organized?
Yes.
And put some names out there. And I don't mean Trump.
Sorry.
He's not a Christian. So he might be manipulated by Christian nationalists, but he isn't a Christian. So I'm not asking his name. Who are these people? Are they the Falwells? The people from Bob Jones University? Demographically, can you be precise? Demographically, are they mainly southern states? States that were part of the Confederacy? Is it just as powerful in among Yankees?
Oh, Jesus, we have some
data, Victor.
That is a good question, and I think you will find the answer if you look at the writers of Project 25.
Yes, that's the ideology.
You know, well, you want to know who they are.
Yeah, well, I know Vance wrote the prologue for introduction, but
there's a long,
then you have a
long list.
There's some institution, some foundation behind that.
More than one.
Isn't it the Brookings or the Heritage Foundation behind that? But it's all sad.
That's fine. That's fine.
Okay.
Okay.
I'd like to add a different thing. Because I think that there's a funny thing that worries me tremendously about American society today. And that we can become very engaged in one-way streets. I can watch television. I can be mesmerized by the Chicago Bears. But I can also turn it off, walk away, and bear no responsibility to it. And it strikes me that part of this organizing is analogous to the difficulties of something like Christian nationalism today. You can be engaged, you can contribute money, you can write a complaint, you can write to your minister, but you can also, in an American society where more and more people don't attend church every Sunday, walk away. So who is a participant in the sense that we historically have thought about participation is a very tricky question. And I think you start with who are these leaders with money, who can mobilize emotion, can mobilize letter writing, but who in another way have a very tenuous and very isolated connection to Christian nationalism. This is not the full scope of what is Christianity, what is Islam. It's a fragment, and you can walk away from it.
Okay, I have a question in the back, and then I have to go to this side, and then over here. So, yes, lady with the sunglasses.
Well, I don't really have a question, but your response to this gentleman's question, one of my book clubs read recently a book called, Diane, correct me if I don't have it right, called The Power Worshippers, and it's a history of Christian nationalism, not just in our country, but all over the world. And so if you're looking for the people who have been responsible for sales, so I'm just throwing that out there. I thought it was really important.
Another really good history is Crispin Covey's Gomez, Jesus and John Wayne. It's easy to read and is a succinct history of America. And if you want to know the names, she's got them. They're all in the book.
And who's going to forget that title?
Yeah.
Sorry. Kind of want to be a devil's advocate here for just a minute.
Please.
Because while I can't really disagree with you about that there are lots of people who are hungry for power, and they're using Christian nationalism and other authoritarian types of ideas to gain power, I also know a lot of people who would consider themselves Christian nationalists in their views. They'd answer yes to all those questions in the survey, even if they wouldn't use that title. And they hold those views because they feel it's a moral obligation as Christians. It's the right thing for them to do, to put Christian ideas, Christian values into all these different parts of government, because it's what God wants them to do. So I'm very interested in the dialogue, because mostly I don't know what to say to them, but I know that shaking my finger at them and telling them you're just a bunch of power-hungry autocrats. So how do you, Jeffrey, respond to that or address that from the pulpit?
Something, well, first of all, is I don't talk like this from the pulpit. Because, again, I respect the diversity of that space, the diversity of who is sitting there. And again, this spectrum of belief, people that they love Jesus, they love their country. And when someone tells me, just like you said, these things are true, this is what God wants us to do, my response is, I say, who told you that? No, really. Who told you that? Where were you taught that? Can you show me in the Bible? That was one of the best places I ever got in my religious instruction. If you have something you say, well, this is biblical. Okay, then show me.
Mm-hmm.
And then let's talk about it. Okay, yeah, you can point to that there is some sort of theocracy in the Old Testament. But there's a very clear passage, at least clear to me, when Jesus is risen and he's about to ascend and the disciples come to him, is now the time to restore the kingdom to Israel? And he doesn't answer. So is that an answer? Maybe. But the important part is that none of us are just vacuums. We were shaped in some ways. People that, again, they loved us. They wanted the best for us. A lot of those views, all those things, that's where I grew up. He said North Dakota, but I grew up right underneath it. I'm from South Dakota. So again, that these things, these ways of believing, that was all I was taught for a long period of my life. But then I had exposure. Then I had dialogue. Then people challenged me saying, who taught you this? Where is it written? And again, part of the beauty, I think, between dialogue, especially between people of the book, Jews, Islam, and Christian, we love our book. And so we want to talk about our book. And each tradition sees varying levels of interpretation. And so the fact that we can't agree, even you come to Christians saying, what does this text mean? They will not agree. So that in itself is important, is, I think, starting that dialogue of, well, where does this teaching come from? Why is it so important? And again, maybe there is such pushback. This is the pastoral part. There's such pushback and such pain, but there maybe is no dialogue. But I think, again, that there's room too to say, okay, well, then we'll go our separate ways. Peter and Paul did not agree, and they still found themselves doing the work. Paul got rid of Mark for a while. But at the end of Paul's life, Mark was there. Same with Isaac and Ishmael. They were together at their father's grave. Somehow, when we face our own mortality, I think there's room there for dialogue. So I want
to... Okay, there was one other question in this corner, and then we can go over to Parker. Yes.
Thank you so much for organizing this and for your question. I have a question. I'm also doing a doctorate in Christian nationalism, and I'm wondering, my research question is phrased a little bit as, how does theology motivate social and political action?
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking about forms of political action. I'm wondering what kinds of political action you're seeing. I mean, we have Project 2025,
mm-hmm.
which is a manifesto for taking over government, but the more everyday forms of political action, are people talking about voting? Are they talking about sticking something up in their garden? Are they talking about, like, what exactly is this political action that people on the ground who you're working with in the field are talking about?
How does theology motivate political action? Specifically, what political action do we see from people motivated theologically? Part of the problem is that it's only reduced to voting in a presidential election. Voting is so important, but you know what the most important battle is? Your local officials, because you can go talk to them at the grocery store. Good luck talking to the president. Or you can talk to the people you have access to. And communities are built around the local community. People you trust, you grew up with, these are the people that you serve together. So vote in your local elections, vote at all levels of society. We're democracy, or I hope we will always be. So voting matters. Another layer of political action is, of course, What we see, the question was raised about, you know, when there is statements made against groups of people that is dehumanizing, political action is we show up and we say, that's not true. We say, this cannot be. You show up, you people are hungry, you feed them. When people are thirsty, you give them water. If you do that, you demand that, again, government serves all people. So political action, I think, most often is reduced to voting, but there's many ways to be involved. Clark, do you have anything to add to that?
I do, but let's get a couple of more questions. I want to go back to this question.
Yes, sir. Next to Betty, and then Beth.
I have the fortune, the good fortune to know Jeffrey. He's my pastor. Clark, Larry Feldman, Fred, I have a question, but I want you to know something of me. I'm a retired history instructor. I was born in Alabama. I have an aunt and an uncle in Alabama that we used to visit when I was young, before or during World War II. Aunt Bertha was a beautiful Black woman. She was a Black woman. Uncle Sonny was as light as Clark, had straight hair and blue eyes. And I believe that Uncle Sonny just passed for Black because it was against the law to be married to a Black woman at that time. And something that I haven't heard, the word that I haven't heard, is hate. And my question is, do we cloak these low gutter type things in Christianity? My wife and I spent the month of August in Belgium. And I've spent a lot of time in Europe. And yes, there is bigotry and hatred and so on everywhere, but I've not experienced it like it is in this country.
Yeah.
My wife talks about straight things, food, when the end comes. And I said, honey, they know where we live. What's the point? They know that you're my wife. What I want to know is, how can we translate this and not have this hatred covered over with the veneer of Christianity?
Now, first of all, you come to my house and they have to go through this first.
I get that sense.
I promise you that. Part of it is that, again, I think you being the historian, Clark, historian as well, so many people in this room are training in, it's always very cloaked. There's something about when we let the worser angels tell us that exceptional means better, that uniqueness means singular control, power. To remove that, dialogue is key. Common ground is key. The thing that I love about Jesus is he doesn't have to be unique to be profound. If we could start saying that about each other, if we could say that about our traditions, about our differences, we wouldn't have to cloak it in religion to just act on that bigotry, right? It's religion becomes a shield for a cloaking measure for that hate, because it's easy, it's digestible. Part of what I was talking about earlier is we have religious freedom. But it's become a weapon because suddenly someone can go out and they can abuse the LGBTQ community. But, oh, I'm just practicing my religion. But it's not. Free speech is not hate speech.
Yeah.
Holy words are not hateful words. But we debate around that. And so I don't have an easy answer for you. But this is part of it. This is part of the solution. We have to keep talking. Because when we do, this comes, I think, from King, but it's hard to hate someone who I'm sitting across from. It's easier to hate when it's behind a wall, when it's behind something, a veil of difference.
Thank you.
I'm sorry.
Oh, I just was going to say, as always, thank you, Robin. I wonder, too, if part of what drives this is that what manifests itself as hate at another level, and maybe even a deeper level, is fear.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to be displaced.
Yep.
And I'm frightened by that. And part of our strategy for I continue to hope is in front of us is that we can reduce that fear. And the person who hates out of a secret sense of no dignity can be relieved and aided and brought to the place where, as you so eloquently said, we must become.
Can I just add something for me? And it's not a question, that's just to say that it is hate based on fear. But the folks that are marginalized, mm-hmm. like people of color, like the LGBTQ community, we need other people who are not marginalized mm-hmm. to do this work.
Yeah.
Not that we're in the trenches, we are every day of our life because we are who we are. But the real shift is going to be when everybody stands up to it, everybody mm-hmm. they are confronted by it. Yeah. And it doesn't have to be this. It doesn't have to be this. Mm-hmm. We continue to meet people where they're at. And I had a biology teacher who believed you can't change gender, blah, blah, blah. It was one of the most contentious people in the world that I've ever spoken with. And I'm sure. I waited. And I stayed at the table and I listened. And I waited for the part where he cared about something. And holy mother of God, this guy did a 180-degree turnaround. And wrote me a letter, and just phenomenal. So again, there's possibilities, but I also know that sometimes the marginalized, we're not able to take it on every time.
Thank you very much, Betty.
My concern is with all of this that I have really a deep understanding of the First Nations people that were on this land long before Christians ever arrived. And I have not forgotten what the Christians did to the First Nations people as they tried to erase their culture and their importance and took their language away, etc. And I am real concerned with this discussion of Christian nationalism and the power connected to it as to what is going to transpire. Is this going to be another what we did to the Native American people across this land? And I and to people who have other religious beliefs. You know, this is a diverse country. We're not all Christians in this country. And I really resent Christians thinking that they may be better than every other religion and their beliefs. And so that's a big fear for me, is if we let this develop, is the same thing going to be happening that we did to the indigenous people of this country long ago? And I fear for that.
Thanks, Betty. Zena.
Thank you both. As I've learned that silence is complicity, and I've got to talk to my relatives and my neighbors from every stripe, sometimes I encounter what I would, I guess, describe as some cognitive dissonance, where they're presented with fact and they sort of shut down. And I'm wondering if you guys have encountered that and if you have any strategies. I think story, the idea of story can help, but I wondered if you had any comments about how to address that when you're trying to talk to someone.
Well,
sure.
These two questions tie together in a way for me. What I'm going to call public theology. And the idea of addressing in theological ways, broadly conceived, to a general public is becoming more and more difficult because you cannot assume the memorization of Bible verses that we went through over and over again as a kid. So there's a very rudimentary knowledge of the theological, and yet I would say it's profoundly important. And it's important because you're trying to figure out what is the question that is given insight, illumination, a sense of direction, of meaning, arising out of your own existential difficulty. And if I can just give one example, I wrote a book about Emily Dickinson a few years ago. Mm-hmm. Emily Dickinson's minister was Edward Hitchcock, a Congregationalist, as it would happen. He was one of the two most prominent geologists in the United States at that time, in the 1840s, 1850s. And one of the things he realized as a geologist was that entire species had come and they had gone and they were no more. And the question, the existential, the public theology question became for Hitchcock as a preacher is less that old question, am I saved or am I damned? But the question, does it mean anything? Mm-hmm. These people, they're going to die, but not just them, all of them, every human, every crinoid stem that you can find in Lake Michigan. It's going to be gone. What does it mean? Is there a way to think theologically, accessibly, about the possible meaning of existence? And one reason that that's important is that it's tempting, as we saw in Jeffrey's excellent discussion, of the way that power can manipulate the answer you would like to give to it. So we can say a lot of things about the indigenous people and John Winthrop, who was the first Puritan minister to arrive, not minister, layperson to arrive in Massachusetts Bay Colony in the 1630s. But one thing I will say for him is that he knew how to raise that public theological question. He wrote a very famous sermon entitled A Model of Christian Charity. Ronald Reagan took it and twisted it around into a discussion of the shining city on the hill. But if you read John Winthrop, the main point he wants to drive home is that we are a city on a hill, which means that that God is visible to you and is judging how you will behave
in the largest possible scheme of things. And I think whatever else theology needs to do is to raise that question. Am I being teased into power, patriarchy, privilege, or am I pushing the real question? What does it all mean? Does it mean anything? What do I need to do to complete something? What is the moral good? Those are hard questions. They're questions that we have to answer together. But that kind of theological language is what I would regard as public theology, in the sense that it has the opportunity to illuminate people who might otherwise say, well, yeah, I used to be religious, but
when you think of heaven, whatever your concept of heaven, I think when people are so exclusive, I say, do you mean to tell me that God is not going to let Mahatma Gandhi in here because he's not a Christian?
Right. I kind of like him.
I have to just ask other people who haven't had a chance.
Phyllis, if it's a short question, just the lecture of the classics. The model lies here. And then, maybe I was making a mistake. One of my questions was, when there's things about this, means how long do we have? How do we set up a doctrine without making it a doctrine ourselves?
Yes.
And this is the League of Women Voters, I'm going to mention our concept, what we do. The League study, the League often chooses a study to make and we study that. We come to a consensus, which is a dialogue, on what we believe and how we want to go about taking action. We talk a lot, and we don't often take action. That may be in our churches, that may be in the League, that may be in many groups that I belong to. If we don't get along, and I don't think we do, we have to take action. Those of us in this room, I think, are probably all on the same level. We're probably all on the same idea that we'd like to take action. Find a leader. Find your congregational minister. Find your minister in your church if they're. Find an interfaith action. Can interfaith action and the League of Women Voters work together? Can we, as a league, and I am a member and a long-time member, not in this group, but in another group, can we take a study, make the study, and determine what action we can take and take positive, specific things that we can do to make this different?
Phyllis, thank you very much. Pictures. Short answer for the League of Women Voters, that the League is looking at various topics and they are working in our advocacy capacity to form that consensus and decide on how to work to push legislation forward and to support things that are good for the community. And we'll try and write a little more about that maybe in the newsletter. So we'll see. Thank you all so much. Bill, I'd love to have another question, but we've got to wrap it up a little bit. And first of all, I think we gave a quiet thank you to Dr. Gilpin and Reverend Hubers. Maybe we could give a little bit. We now know more about Christian nationalism and how it affects our politics and religious practices. This knowledge will help us and our guests at home think about making informed choices, and now I speak as one of other voters, make informed voices when have choices when they vote. I have to say this. The League of Women Voters does not support or impose any political party or candidate for elected office or any group that supports candidates. And though we're called the League of Women Voters, not just happy to have anyone who wants to join. If you're not currently there, you can pick up a brochure on your way out, and that will get you places to go to for information about the league. And Interfaith has something.
Okay, Interfaith Action. This is a short commercial, but we've talked a lot about crossing denominational lines and belief lines. Please, please, please consider coming to the celebration of the harvest and the harvesters at Tabor Hill Vineyards on October 6th at 3 p.m. All are welcome. We have a broad diversity of presenters, imams, priests, other denominations. And I think it's going to be a wonderful event for us to sort of carry on some of this discussion. So that's October 6th at Tabor Hill. It's open to all. And it's at the event center, not the restaurant.
Yes.
That's a Sunday at 3 p.m.